You're listening to episode 2 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this show, we talk with video game script developer Mike West. Running time for this episode is 59 minutes. Welcome to the Fear the Boot interview series, episode 2. My name is Dan, and with me is Adam.
Hi.
And joining us from Seattle is Tex again.
Hello.
Who you guys may remember. He joined us, I believe it was an episode 28 or 29.
It was one of the beginning of the design series.
Very first one of the design series. He was down here with us and joined us, and he's back again. And today we are talking to Mike West.
Hi there.
Now, Mike, before we get into any of the topics we'd like to discuss with you today, why don't you go ahead and give a little bit of a resume, just so everybody knows exactly who you are.
Okay, sure. I've been in the games industry about 13 years now. Started off as a coder, long way back, just making football games to the 3D engine. Then went on to another company where I became lead designer on a strategy game. After that, went to another company, did another strategy game, another RTS, wrote the whole AI for that system. And now I'm at Lionhead, so I'm the lead scripter on Fable 2. I was one of the senior scripters on Fable 1, basically drafted in at the end to get the really complicated stuff in. And I was lead scripter on Fable TLC as well.
Now, what exactly does a lead scripter do?
That's a good question. I actually had to tell the rest of the team what I did the other day. and did a Friday. We each take turns, do a Friday meeting. So I sat down and told them what scripting is.
You know, when no one you work with knows what you do, it's a sign you're about to get downsized. So,
well, the coders tend to know what we do, but no one else does. I think they just think we, you know, write a bit of text every now and then. Basically, my department implements all the quests in the game. So every single element of the story that isn't the sandbox. So we don't do the AI for the characters walking around town. We don't do the creatures fighting. We don't create the landscapes. But anybody that says anything that isn't AI is handled by script. Any quest that does anything, any weather that suddenly changes for a specific region, anything, pretty much. The whole story, any secret event, any demon door. Yeah, so we stop the game being a sandbox, and that's pretty much what we do. So everyone was quite surprised when I told them.
When I told people this episode was coming up, I had a few people ask why an RPG podcast is talking to a guy that does video games. And there's a couple reasons for that. First of all, within this podcast, for these interviews, we'd like to talk to anything that is at least within one degree of role-playing games. So if we can get something that we think is going to be interesting to the geek population as a whole, whether it be comics or movies or video games, I wouldn't hesitate to bring someone like that into the interview series. But with Mike West specifically, there is a little bit more of a reason that we have him on. We have talked repeatedly on this show about the relationship between video games and role-playing games. And we've talked about how, in some sense, they are competing over the single amount of free time that the consuming audience has. And we've also talked about how there are many elements of tabletop role-playing that we feel are not currently well represented within video games. And if you followed us for a while, you've heard at least one or two of these conversations in the past. And after we did bonus episode 10, which is where we talked at length about storytelling in video games, Mike West sent me an email saying, hey, I've got a lot of insight on this, obviously, given what he does, and I would love to talk to you guys about it. And so at the time, we were still just kicking around the idea of an interview series. So we said, hey, look, hold on for a little bit. Let us get some things straightened out and we'll get back to you. And we did. And of course, here we are talking to him now. So we've got a whole series of things that are going to be about video games, but we are always going to bring this back to the central context of the role-playing game market. So, Mike, let me start with this question. If you were listening to our podcast, I'm going to assume you're also a tabletop gamer. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I was passed on to it by another guy at work. He's also a gamer. There's quite a few gamers, and there's a lot of board gamers as well in the company and in the industry as a whole. So, yeah, so, I mean, I used to play AD&D, Tunnels and Trolls, you know, the simpler version, but I was always the DM because generally the people that get in the games industry are the people that are used to making games and used to entertaining people. So that's why we do it. There's a lot of frustrated DMs that basically wanted to implement things to a mass market rather than just their four mates in around their house on a weekday evening. I can write a story now, or I can implement a quest and have millions of people play it. And that's awesome for me. And I can't do that with pen and paper.
I'm a firm believer the way that you view role-playing games has a lot to do with how you play them. When you played a game, how would you describe yourself? Were you guys more into the dungeon crawl? Was it storytelling? Which came first, the simulation or the drama?
It was possibly 60% the crawling and the fighting, and 40% the interaction. Because I'm quite a major character guy, so I did all the stupid voices and all the silly events. And I was always trying to play a game in such a way that I was making the guys think. I remember one experience I had, just really cool. I gave a guy a magic ring, and it reflected any spell cast on him. But I also passed him a bit of paper and said, you know, when you're wearing this ring, you have to disagree with whatever the rest of the party told you to do, or, you know, subtly, not really obviously. And we just got in some really interesting situations where they're asking what the ring does, you know, he must know what it does, and he just wouldn't tell them. And in the end, they ended up casting Fireball on him and killed themselves. So I thought that was quite amusing. So it's things like that. I really like, you know, making people think. And it's not just the basic, oh, this is a creature, this is how you kill it. It's the areas above that. I mean, we weren't so much into the town stuff at that time, because obviously, you know, we were 13, 14. It was all about going down and killing goblins and things like that. But, you know, since then, I've obviously moved much, much more into that area.
When's the last time you played a tabletop game like that?
The only problem with it now is obviously because I'm a full-time games designer, it's less likely that we want to spend our evenings, one of us actually having to do that, one of us having to DM. We're all quite up to playing it, but last year I played some Call of Cthulhu, so that was probably the last we played. That was a good one. That was the King in Yellow, we played that one. So yeah, that was all guys from Lionhead, all guys I work with. And we play a lot of board games, I say. So we play like Runebound or something, you know, which has role-playing elements, but obviously is nowhere near as detailed as a role-playing game.
How long have you been with Lionhead exactly? Like, if you were to put this in a context of games, when you joined the company, which game was the first that you worked on?
Fable. Fable was the first, and Fable was a big, big game. So since Fable, it was Fable TLC, then Fable 2, and that's been a pretty much full-time job. So I've been there about 3.5 years now. And at the time when Fable was coming out, Black and White 2 was coming out, and the movies was coming out. So, you know, you stuck on one, and because we had a lot of people there at the time.
Before we turn the mics on, you were talking about the development of Fable, saying that there had been a lot of things promised for Fable that simply weren't delivered. And I was wondering if you talk about that for a minute here, some of the things that you guys wanted to do with the game and why they ultimately did not make it in there.
It's a simple case with Fable was there was a lot of things we wanted to do. And when it comes down to it, you have a deadline and you have marketing shouting at you saying this has to be out on this day. And when it just came down to it, we didn't have time to get everything in, so we had to pick and choose the best bits. And the real problem for us was we talked about the things we were doing all the way through the product cycle, and we were doing those things and we were putting them in, but when it came down to it, we couldn't polish them all up to the level we wanted to.
Can you give me a couple examples of things that didn't make it?
Having children, that was, I believe, in Fable. We could have put children in, but they wouldn't have been good enough. And that's the thing about Lionhead, and now we're Microsoft. Everything that goes into Fable and everything that goes into one of our games is polished to the max. It's going to be excellent if we put it in. And if we can't make it excellent, then we have to make a decision, and the decision is to drop it. And that's always a problem. And we're doing Fable 2 now. We're being a lot more conscious about what we're telling people because we don't want to disappoint people. But if you take Fable as a game without knowing the history of what we have promised, it's a great game. But if you take it on, we've promised 100 things and we've delivered 60. If you just got those 60 things without any promise, you'd think this is great. So we've learned our lesson, I hope.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because in bonus episode 10, one of the things that we, specifically Chad, were lamenting was that video games are often marketed based purely on their graphical prowess. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I remember Fable being one of those games that was actually being marketed on things other than the pixel count.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the way I've always had it at Lionhead, our games are some of the best-looking games that ever come out. And I know I'm never worried about someone talking about our game looking fantastic because I always know it will do. I am always worried when people talk about what's going to be in the game, because when you're developing it and when you're working on different areas and basically things get talked about and they come out in the press, which is cool because you have to keep the marketing running. It's just a bit concerning when, you know, a large number come out as did on Fable. As I say, Fable 2, that's not happening. So that's cool.
If you're getting ready to put out a video game and let's say, going back to your figure, there's 100 features in it and you know that you're only going to be able to bring 60 to market, just to keep using your numbers. Yep. I realize some of these may be easy decisions when we're trying to figure out what the 40 are we're going to drop. You could say, you know, maybe this feature just isn't far enough along, whereas this one is. So simply for the purposes of we can get this one quicker than the other, we'll drop the one that's going to take longer. But it also strikes me that when all things are equal and you have features that are relatively the same distance along, that at this point you almost have to bring some kind of a value system to bear.
Yep.
That says we consider these features to be more important than these other features. And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about what that sort of value system is and why it is you think they pick some features over others to keep.
Sure. Basically, the way that works is you end up listing all the features that are, I mean, you'll have some features which are going in because they're core. You've got, you know, you've got your basic combat, and for Fable, you've got things like AI, and you've obviously got quests, you've got the engine, you've then got interactions with the world, and you've got the basic set that have to go in. Then you start having to look at the reward versus the cost, and the cost split into two things, which is time and risk. And basically it's time multiplied by risk. So if something looks like it's going to take a long time to implement, it gets a high number. If it looks like it's going to be really difficult and something could go wrong on development, or it's a complete unknown, we haven't done it before, that's a big risk. So then you multiply those two together and that will give you a number. So say it was a 3 risk and a 3 size, you end up with a 9, and then you compare that to the benefit. So how cool a feature is it going to be once it's in? And you give that a rating from 1 to 5. And then from that, that gives you a pretty basic idea of the features that is worth keeping. Obviously, the coolness is also balanced on the game type we're making. So because it's Fable, because people know what Fable is now, we're looking at Fable 2 features, and oh, we've got to have that because that was in Fable. People will expect, you know, feature X to be in Fable 2, otherwise we lose part of the Fable franchise. So you have to make some difficult decisions. Right at the beginning of Fable 2, it's like, what are we doing then? Okay, we're doing this. These 7 things are the most important things in the game. And I know for a fact that one of those is now not in it anymore. But that's fine, because there are other things that are now in taking its place. But we have to morph what we want the game to be as you develop, because as you find things that you thought were simple, they're not as simple as you thought they were. And things that you thought were difficult, they weren't as difficult as you thought we were. So you have a first, the first section of the project, it's usually... It starts off very small with only a few designers, and then you get some prototype coders on, and they start working on the real risks, and obviously getting the basic engine up and running. But you work in the prototyping stage, which of those risks are truly risky? And at one point you have to go, we've spent enough time realizing we still don't know how to do this, it's got to get dropped. And that's basically how you do it. It's risk, time versus payoff.
One of the things that we have kicked around on this show is it strikes us that there is a great deficiency in storytelling in video games. You can go the route of the Japanese RPGs, where you get a very deep and very compelling story, but it's also a unidirectional story. You are somebody, and the plot just carries you along, and cutscene movies tell what's happening along the way. Versus a game that may be something more like, let's say, the Fallout series, where you have much greater control over who you are and what you do, but because of the fact that video game developers can't possibly make a great deal of detail for each of the possible resultant branches of that tree. You know, if I walk up to a person and decide I'm good or evil, and then I make another decision, we've grown that tree exponentially at every step. And it's just impossible to program enough story with sufficient depth for all those. So the story becomes a little bit more shallow and uninvolved. And I'm curious, what is the future of that? Is this pretty much here to stay? Do you guys have these new and wonderful things in mind to change it? Does nobody care? Is everyone putting all the emphasis on graphics? And
well, each department cares about their own area. So you talk to a coder, he couldn't care less about the story. You talk to me, I don't care less about the graphics. So, no, I'm totally from your side, point of view. We're working on the story a lot at the moment. I've been in possibly, I think, 3 weeks of meetings now, and every day it's a 7-hour meeting on the story. We're almost doing quest at a time. And if we didn't care about the story, we wouldn't certainly wouldn't be spending any time like that on it, especially at this point in the project as well. So we definitely care about it. And it's a case of you've got to look at what we can do and you've got to look at what we can't do at the moment. And at the moment, you can't generate speech. We can generate text. We could do a game where all of the conversations between characters were simply text. And then you could start doing what you're saying. You could start having intrigue between people. I know back in the day, what's the one before Morrowind?
The second Elder Scrolls game?
Daggerfall. Daggerfall was a lot more open, I felt, than both the next two games, because it was all based on text. You could go and talk to any leader of any town and do jobs for them, and they would then pit you against other people. And that was a very basic way of doing it at the time, but it really enthralled me, as I could really go and get a quest off anyone and go up in any town, and that towns were infinitely made across the world, and there were, you know, loads of them. And it's basically trying to find the middle ground between the two, because obviously, as you're saying, there's not much depth there. So one way of doing it is having not just one story arc, but having multiple story arcs with decisions on many of the arcs. So you've got one arc, which is your main character story. You've got another arc, which is, I don't know, with some evil witch in the hills or something, and her arc could be a completely different thing. You could end up being the witch in the hills, or you could end up marrying her, or you could end up blah blah blah. But while you're doing that, you've got another story arc somewhere else, which is the main story arc. Because we can do a story arc fine, but only with a number of options within that story arc, we can actually have a large number of story arcs now, and that's just content. So content's fine, we can put in as much content as we want. To go back to just having one story arc with a limitless number of opportunities, that's, as I say, with speech, that is at the moment nigh on impossible, unless everyone sounds like Stephen Hawking, which we can't really have, unfortunately. That's what all our characters sound like at the moment, actually. But, yeah, without doing that at the moment, the speech is the main problem. If you were to say, we don't need speech, then it's possible.
Now, can you walk us through the process of how a quest goes from an idea in somebody's head to fully implemented in the game?
Mm-hmm. Do you want to give me an idea?
yes, I have to kill 10 bears and deliver a package.
I got a better one for you.
Okay.
There's a guy being interviewed on a podcast who, to make a deadline, needs a new quest idea. And so
I was wondering, though, if you give me an... I'll tell you exactly what we'd need to do any idea you want, because that's what I do every day. I come up with the ideas with the design department, and then I take those ideas with the script department, and we come up with a way of implementing them, and that's my daily job, so I can be thrown anything at any point. So
okay, well, let's do something romantic and cliche at the same time.
Okay.
So let's say that there's a beautiful girl in the town, and she's about to marry her fiancé, but her old boyfriend is jealous and steals the wedding ring and hides it away in the woods. And mm-hmm. Now the fiancé comes to you. He's all upset because the wedding is supposed to be next week and the wedding ring is missing.
Yeah. The first thing you do on that front is you work out the flow of the quest. So you work out what are the possible outcomes. So in this case, the possible outcomes are you get the guy back with his fiancé. Say that's the good option, is to get the new fiancé back with his fiancé. They're both called fiancé, aren't they? It's really confusing. Or the old option is to get the old ex back with the fiancé, because maybe he's going to pay you a ton. If you go and track him down, he's like, oh, I've never liked him. If you can knock off the new guy in the way, I'll get back with her. It'd be great. Or you could just go for the, I'm just going to kill everyone route. So
I like every solution so far involves murder.
Yeah. The first one didn't. The first one was nothing to do with murder.
Well, the ex had to get killed.
Yeah, that would be the second one. Oh, the ex, you don't have to kill the ex. You just need to get him out of the way.
Well, he's obviously crazy if he's stealing the ring, so...
Well, yeah,
he's probably stalking her, too.
He might just need a good talking to, that's all. So the first thing is, okay, you work out your possible outcomes. And once you've got your outcome, you make a workflow of the script. So we tend to use Visio or something like that with a nice workflow with every single conversation you can have in the game, in that quest, is then written down into a small box. So it's like, talk to the guy, what are the possible outcomes? He can say do this, he can say do that, so... You talk to the first person, he says, can you get my ring? Obviously, at this point, you can say no. That's one option, which means the quest doesn't really start. The second option is, yes, I can go and get your ring. Add this all into one big document. You get all the flow. Then you take the flow, and that gets handed to a scripter. So then we take those individual boxes, and then we create cutscenes around them, which are the conversations with the players, with the characters. I can't tell you exactly what they're going to be in Fable 2. They're going to be new and excitingly different, but I can't tell you how, unfortunately.
Well, let me ask you a question about this, actually.
Sure.
Because right here, the thing that you're talking about is one of the things that we have kicked around as a major hurdle to interactive storytelling in most video games. That if, mm-hmm. if I'm sitting around telling a story to someone or playing a role-playing game or any similar sort of pursuit, and yep. we come to a turning point in that story, I can do any number of things with any number of nuances to them to respond yep. to this. So if in the video game you guys decided that I can get the ring back, talk down the fiancé, off the ex-boyfriend, we come up with half a dozen possibilities.
Exactly.
But if we're sitting around a tabletop, then all of a sudden I could decide, you know what, I'm going to do none of the above. I'm going to kidnap the girl for myself, and yeah, I'm going to create a new ring and lie to him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it seems that as long as video games are stuck to those decision trees, and until someone makes some kind of a great innovation that moves to a completely different model, video game storytelling will always be very heavily limited. And one of the things that we kicked around is we have seen some video games try to take separate approaches to the artificial intelligence, where instead of there being one master AI engine, each individual character may have its own ability to make decisions. For example, in the old video game Creatures, the little Norns in there actually, instead of having sort of a true decision tree, they had impulses. And based on the impulses and physical factors that the game estimated was inside of the creature, different instincts or needs would bubble to the top, causing them to act a certain way. I think they tried something a little bit similar in Oblivion. Everyone has some kind of an immediate desire, and based on that, they would do things that the game makers could not necessarily predict from just standing back and looking at the game. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, is there any real push to take the time or the energy or whatever to take this whole thing back to the drawing board, as they have done with graphic engines many times over, and say, you know what, we need a whole new way to tell stories in video games that is neither a linear movie nor a Boolean sort of decision tree?
All those things you're talking about are generally fit under the whole scope of emergent gameplay, is what it's generally called in the industry, which means you put in an engine and then you just let it go, and you go to see what happens. So there's quite a few, not necessarily from the role-playing side of things, but you're starting to get physics engines in games now, and there's solutions to puzzles which you can just make up by just doing something sensible, by dropping a boulder onto a plank and putting something on the other side of the plank, something will fly in the air and knock it off, and the person implementing the puzzle might not have thought that was the solution. So you're starting to get that thing with that side of things. Now, with AI, at the moment, because that's such a different... I mean, I worked on a neural network at university, so I was teaching a robot how to follow a torch. But I've seen very few neural networks in the games industry because it's such a new technology still. And we don't have many neural network experts. So if you want to start using all these extra layers of intelligence, you generally need the people with some expertise in it. And at the moment, I don't see any.
Why is that?
Because those people are generally working on AI research in robotics and stuff like that. We have an AI department in Fable. We have characters with daily routines, with what they want out of life, and you can cheer them up. You can do things to make them feel differently. And because of that, they will perform things we're not necessarily expecting them to. But obviously, with our time frame, we can't come up with a whole brand new AI system, because this is what I mean about earlier on about risks. That is a huge risk. To say at the beginning, we're going to come up with a totally new AI routine where all these characters have wants, like Creatures, as you say, is the whole game. The whole game is that. There's no story in that. There's not a huge amount of gameplay in it, but that's not a problem necessarily, because it's a fun system to base a game around. So, yeah, basically, if you do put that in, that is such a massive risk for the game, then that becomes the game. So you end up not being able to spend time on other elements of the game. And to actually get that into a publisher and say, our game is going to be this, and they're saying, well, what are you doing it? Well, all these characters in the game have their own feelings and their wants and their needs and etc. And then you can affect those by what you do. But what do you actually do? Well, that's the thing. Depending on what you do, different things happen. What are they? Well, we don't quite know yet. And to say that to a publisher, the publisher's going to be terrified and run away. And that's one of the biggest problems with the games industry at the moment, from my point of view. If someone comes up with a truly unique idea, it's very difficult to sell. Unless the person coming up with the idea is absolutely huge in the industry. So like Spore's got through because, you know, the guy doing it is massively famous and he can just come up with what he wants and he's got enough money to do what he wants. But if anyone else had come up with that idea, that simply would not be being made. If you come up with a truly new way of doing something, you have to have spent enough time on it to prove it can work before you can spend time on it, if that makes sense. So when you are now getting to the situation of people being able to make their own games in their bedrooms, again, like you could in the 80s on your BBCs and your Spectrums and stuff, you might get more of it now. You might start to get little groups of people coming up with their own role-playing games, which probably are very graphic light, but end up having a really interesting back model to them. And then once they come to light and someone goes, wow, that's really cool, if it looked better, this could sell millions. Publishers are unimaginative, in my opinion. I have to qualify it. Developers, very imaginative people, but they're not generally allowed to be. And it's very frustrating. I've been in the industry 13 years, and if as a developer, it's very difficult to get a new idea across. The easiest games to sell to a publisher and to get money to help you develop a game is a Me Too game, which is an RTS comes out. Oh, we're doing RTS, Me Too. And they're like, great, fantastic. This will be a better RTS than that one. It's really frustrating.
We talked about this exact idea. I couldn't tell you the episode, but several episodes back. And we expressed a frustration that this seems to right now be the common theme in pretty much all of the entertainment industries.
Yeah, I was just about to say.
That if you want to try to put out a novel, that's what they look for. Are you a big name, or is this an obvious me too? If you want to put out a song or get a band out, are you somebody famous, or is this a me too? We can slip into a simple little corporate niche. Now,
role-playing games.
Yeah,
it's the indie markets that's driving the innovative games.
But I guess one of the things that's different about video games is if I want to sit down and write a novel, assuming we're talking about a fictional novel, it doesn't require any weird research, the cost to make all fictional novels is basically the same. It's a certain number of man hours and a copy of MS Word. If I want to sit down and create my own music, the recording equipment and instruments may be a little expensive, but most people that are even just doing it as a hobby, they can get a hold of that stuff and record something. But with a video game, there is such an enormous technical burden to leap there. Is this something where do you think a bunch of guys sitting around with XNA or sitting around with whatever their preferred tool is, just dorking around at home, can ever possibly do major innovation in?
I think it depends what game they're working on. You can't make Fable like that. That would not happen simply because of the graphics engine. That's the single point that would use it. It's just impossible. There are many types of games you could do easily with that. You could easily do a lot of strategy games you could do with that. Anything 2D you could do. You know, you could do the next fantastic XCOM or something like that. You could make fantastic games. You could do management games. You could do board games, obviously. First-person shooters, you're going to have trouble. If you want a role-playing game that isn't massively 3D with fantastic effects and stuff, of course you can do the AI side. That's not the issue. The issue isn't making a game that plays fantastically well. The biggest amount of time spent on any project is all the art, all the animation, and all the people making the engine. And if you don't have any of that element, so if you're making the best RPG game ever, but it's in 2D, it's not a problem. The problem is, you won't be able to sell it to a publisher. But if you're working on your own and you're putting it on Xbox Live or you're putting it online in the future, that's not a problem. It's not going to be a problem because you're going to get the fans of the game who actually care about what the game is and less about what it looks like because they're more into it. One of the things we do while developing Fable is we have an imaginary character called Granny Mojo. And it's all about if Granny Mojo gets it, then everyone gets it. And we have to believe that all the time. And that's one of our cruxes, one of the main things with our development.
What is this Granny Mojo?
Exactly. Granny Mojo is someone's grandma. We just call her Granny Mojo.
Okay, so just if some random grandma who's never touched a video game,
if she's sitting there watching you play and she gets what you're doing, then we're hitting the maximum number of possible people we can. If she goes, oh, can I try playing that card game that you're playing in the pub? Then we've hit it. Then that's brilliant. Then that's got someone who's never played a computer game before. And that's what we're going for, because we're with Microsoft, and Microsoft are with the Xbox, and the Xbox is trying to expand the number of people playing games, because that's going to help them in the long run, of course, then that's what we're doing at the moment. Now, if you're someone who is more aiming at a role-playing market, aiming at, you know, the strongest story-led, AI-driven, deep, intense, you know, feelings on every single level, then you don't need to make it look fantastic. You don't, because Granny Mojo isn't going to come over and play Hack or Angband or whatever you want to call it these days, because it's characters. You know, it's just text characters. I love it. I sit there playing that for hours still, you know, these days. Because I'm a role player, I can imagine that I'm going down into this dungeon and I'm finding this fabled artifact and I'm killing dragons, but actually I'm just walking around attacking a capital D. And that's what it comes down to. And I think, you know, once you've got to the point of you've made the game which doesn't look great, which anybody can do, which I can do by myself, no problem, which other people can do with some training, then that's fine. But once you've got the idea and you can say, look, this is the idea, it's actually a great game, and then you can start pushing for somebody else to come along and say, you've got that great game, let's make it look good.
You know, let's approach that same idea from the standpoint of the major video game producers out there. When you're a little kid, you remember the playground to be extremely big. You go back when you're an adult and it's not nearly as big as you remember. And I've seen this a little bit with video games, where there are some games that I play that I recall as just being the greatest thing since sliced bread. Go back, pick them up later, and they really weren't all that. However, there have also been a lot of games where even upon recently going back and playing emulated versions or finding something I can still actually work and playing it, I can see in these games that there really was a flexibility of gameplay and there really was a depth and a nuance of storytelling that very, very few video games on the market today really come close to replicating. And just from our armchair pontifications, we have always assumed that this is because there is so much pressure now to make the games graphically innovative and to put all this production value around them that the actual core of gameplay, which really does not necessarily have an easily quantified value the way some of these other things might, just sort of gets kicked into the background by the people that are making the decisions. Do you think that's an accurate assessment?
I think at some companies that is. I think at some companies it's all about the back of the box. It's all about the screenshots. It's all about getting some kid to pick up a box and say to his mum, I want this. Look, there's flames on the back. And I think that's obviously really
sad. If it was actually on fire, that would be a cool game.
But as I said, from the other point of view, you've got to tend to make games that are mass market. I've worked on games in the past where you're trying to make something deep and involving, and you're trying to have crazy twists happening, and someone says, is the player going to get that? And I'm like, well, of course they're going to get it. Are you sure, though? It's like, I mean, this, well, I won't say, actually, because I'll probably insult some people. But I was going to say, is a wrestling fan going to get it? You know, that, and that's...
Well, no, that's a very legitimate concern, because I don't want to specifically name the game, but there was a game that came out with a demo on Xbox Live, and those of us that really, really like games that involve a lot of thinking and planning and strategy loved it. But a lot of the you know, the 14-year-olds who downloaded it thought the game was too slow, too ponderous, and they got bored with it. And so I thought it was one of the greatest games I've played on the Xbox 360, but it didn't do all that well because a lot of people thought it's too slow.
Well, and that's one of the difficult things about the corporate angle of this, is to someone who's sitting here interested in these deeper games, I could take the elitist attitude of, you know, if they don't get it, screw them, make it anyway. But of course, you guys are not necessarily first and foremost in this to make great games. You're in this first and foremost to make money.
Well, I quickly reply to that. I'm in this to make great games that make money.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, and I realize that there are individuals in the field that are there to make great games, but the reason you have corporate backers with large pocketbooks is because of the fact that you're making money.
Well, actually, you have a little bit of a liberty right now, and the purpose of Microsoft Game Studios is to make flagship games that set the bar and set the standards. And so if you notice, a lot of the MGS games have very slow, long publication cycles. But the purpose of that, then, is when you finally do ship, it's to set that standard that everybody else makes the Me Too game for. For example, Halo 2 was the first game to have host migration. Or when we launched Xbox Live, almost all of our initial games were made by Microsoft Game Studios. And it was we were the ones that everybody else did the Me Too on, but also there was that huge risk of setting the first standard or taking a long time to publish the game. You know, you sunk a lot of money into the development and potentially ran the risk of, because you weren't making a Me Too, having a game that nobody liked.
With Fable 2, there's a couple of things. Again, I can't speak about specifics. There's a number of elements we're adding to the computer game, role-playing game, which haven't been done before. And that is causing us a lot of effort and a lot of stress, and it's very difficult. But we are going to actually, from what we're doing in a number of areas, we're going to make all role-playing games better. Because of a couple of things we're doing, like the way we're presenting stuff, and it's making it more flowing, and it's going to work. It's going to be really cool. But the problem is, every game that comes out after us, they're going to have to do it too. And they're going to hate us, which is good in some ways, because we got the time to do it first. Back to the point of the story can be too complicated for somebody. The way we're getting around that is, if you make the core stuff not less complicated, but it can still be deep, it can still have characterization, it can still have feeling. As long as we just tone down the complexity somewhat, we can put all the complexity, as much complexity as you want. And to be honest, as much difficulty, it's similar with difficulty of a game as well. You make the core less difficult, but you make all the side quests much deeper, more complex, more interesting. And then the people that want that, the people that want to go away and go, oh, who is this guy? I'll go into his house and look in the book. Oh, look, here's his diary, and this is his backstory, and this is who he is. And, oh, he's married to that one. Oh, I didn't know. You know, and you've got all this back, like... Fable 1 had a hell of a load of backstory that we didn't even get round to talking about how the world was created, and we haven't been able to talk about that at all. And again, in Fable 2, we're going to talk about that more, but we're not going to talk about it more in the core story, because the average player, or a percentage of players, aren't interested in it, and they're going to be pressing the A button to skip whatever we're talking about. But then for the deeper players, for the guys like you who want to go, well, who was that guy then? You can go and find out who they were, and you can go and find secrets, and you can go and unlock things, and... You've got to put that on the side, because if you put it in the middle, you'll turn some people off.
You know, I was thinking about one of Dan's earlier questions about what if somebody made, or somebody or a small group of people made something that was really great and innovative, and if it made it into a game. And I was able to think of several recent examples of that, but they were all tech demos. They weren't anything around role-playing or storytelling. I mean, for example, RoboBlitz, the Xbox Live Arcade game, was actually created as a demo for a physics engine. And they were showing it off at trade shows, and people were like, hey, this physics engine tech demo is really fun. You should make it a game. And so they did. But that had nothing to do with role-playing or storytelling.
I was actually going to ask a question kind of along those lines, and I'm asking this towards Mike, but actually, Tex, you may have some insight on this one, too. Obviously, if something breaks big, no matter where it comes from, people will pay attention. But so my question is very specifically, is anyone paying attention to the little guy before that point? For example, if I'm sitting here at home and I've got my XNA kit or whatever one's in technology I prefer to use, and I write a game that has a really neat AI concept and it gets out there, is there anyone in the industry who actually takes the time to keep an eye on what is going on from these little independent groups to see if there are great ideas to leverage into larger games? Or is this just they are probably never really going to look at it or want to do it until suddenly I'm the next big breakout hit on mini clips or whatever?
Well, actually, Mike and I were talking about this very subject while you were having lunch.
Oh.
The short answer is there's currently no official formal process, no. I know we do watch our community. The XNA guys absolutely love their product and they love the community, and they get really excited whenever they see somebody in the community write something cool with XNA. But that's just because they love it and they're passionate about it and they love to watch the community. There's no official procedure where somebody in the community can make something and submit it for review.
I think there's 3 points on this. The first point is you can look at YouTube and compare it with videos. Anyone can throw anything on YouTube, but when it comes to it, the good stuff rises to the top because people start recommending it to their friends, it starts to come. And in the end, you get stuff at the top and, yeah, there's two guys in a bedroom and now they've got a TV show.
And yeah, that same phenomenon I'm having with Counter-Strike on the Half-Life mod.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's the first element. The second element, and I think this is going to be really, really, really massively important in the future. I don't think it's going to happen for a few years, but I think it's going to change the whole face of computer gaming. And that's with direct downloading. And the fact that when you go into your shop, and I'll talk about it from pounds, and you can convert it to dollars. You go into a shop and you buy a game for £40, say, £39.95. Probably about £10 of that goes to the developer, the guy who's actually made the game. A good percentage of it, a good £10, £15, goes to the shop, and the rest goes to the publisher. Now, when you've got direct download, apart from hosting the actual file on your server, all the money from whatever that game costs goes straight to the developer. You don't need a publisher, because what's the publisher going to do? He might put it on a few more sites for you. You can do that yourself. And that means the money is going to go a lot more, say 10 years' time, it's going to be piping straight into the developers, which means all the money spent on adverts and, you know, that will still happen, but it'll be much less so. I can see the developers becoming much more profitable, which means more developers will exist because more money will go back into developers. And therefore, you'll be able to have a much wider range of games coming out. Because at the moment, you can only have a developer if you've got a publisher. Whereas we won't need the publishers in, say, 10, 15 years. And you're going to have small teams all over the place making completely crazy ideas, and they won't need a publisher. They'll just go, well, let's do it ourselves. Let's stick it up there, say it's $5, because we'll get $5. If they go with a publisher today, and they have to go and get in a box and blah, 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 it goes in the shop, they get $5. It's going to be completely different. I mean, it's going to be fantastic.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that, because I had never really thought about applying this sort of logic to video games. The fact that we are sitting here doing this podcast right now is a testament to the whole power of this quote-unquote new media idea, the idea that anyone can get out there using the internet as their platform, and if they create good content and put it in front of the world, then it can now become a major force. I can sit here and do this podcast because of the fact that I no longer have to appease the FCC or find a radio station that actually believes in this show or believes in this topic. I don't have to meet any advertising targets or whatever. I can just put it out there. The same thing's true of blogs. It was a couple years ago that people suddenly realized just how much power the blogs have when compared to traditional newspapers or other forms of print media. And I had never really stopped and thought about trying to apply that same kind of paradigm to the future of video games, because I guess somewhere in the back of my head, I had always just considered that unlike a podcast, a video game is so complicated to put together that it is never going to, you're never going to see someone sitting in their basement crank out the next Half-Life.
Yeah, but so, haven't they released, like, you don't have to develop the engine from the ground up, though.
Yeah,
they released the Havoc engine for open source.
They are. They're releasing a lot of game engines. They're even releasing a lot of base, like, graphic models and such.
But that you can... Well, you're starting to see the tip of the iceberg already. I mean, for example, one of my favorite game developers right now, studios, is NinjaBee. And they're a very small shop in Utah, but they've been able to publish games for the Xbox Live Arcade. They made Outpost Koloki, they made Clone and Clyde, and they're coming out with Band of Bugs. Each one of them was original and creative and isn't really a Me Too game. And I think the studio is probably too small, I think, to make what we would consider to be a AAA $60 full-on retail game. But they're able to have these neat and creative little ideas and bring them to market through Xbox Live Arcade, where you've got, you know, the $5 or $10 game. So I think we're already starting to see small shops that maybe couldn't publish on consoles before able to, not at the $60 level, but at the $10 level.
From my point of view, you're not going to get someone making the next Half-Life, because you hear AAA, you know, that's like a quadruple A. That's like a genre-defining game. I don't think you're going to get a genre-defining game, again, in a graphical-heavy genre. I think if you wanted to say someone can make the next Fallout, certainly, someone can make the next Fallout. They can take a graphics engine, which is better than a lot of the role-playing game graphics engines. I'm not necessarily talking about Fable, but a lot of role-playing games have pretty poor graphics engines, generally. I think they sort of scrimp and save on that element. But you can certainly get some off-the-shelf graphics engines, and then the background of a role-playing game is not as complicated as doing a new graphics engine. So you're more likely to get a strategy. I mean, on a slightly different front, if you took Championship Manager, which is a really big football management game, and now Football Manager in England, and that's made by a team of guys, I'm pretty sure two guys could make that. You know, it's a case of they've got to sit there for a while and type a hell of a lot. But if you're really keen on football, if you really know how football works, and you're a big stat head, you can make that in your bedroom. And in 10 years, say, if you made it in your bedroom and it came out and people started playing and they really liked it, you could sell hundreds of thousands in England. You could sell millions probably if it was a top notch, and you got it in such a way that it was less aimed at the people that Championship Manager is or whatever. You could do it with that, and there's no reason why you couldn't do that with a role-playing game or an RTS or a strategy game. I don't think you'll be able to have people coming out with completely unique first-person shooters or massive action RPGs like Fable. I think there's too much money to actually make those, but there's so many genres of games, and role-playing is certainly one of them, where, yes, people in their bedrooms will be able to make top games. I intend to be one of those people anyway.
Well, Mike, one question I wanted to ask you about, because this has kind of been weighing on me for a while, is cooperative play. Mm-hmm. In a lot of RTS games, you see the ability to have cooperative play, either groups of players against the computer or groups of players against each other. And you see it a lot in first-person shooters. Mm-hmm. But I've noticed in my experience that you see very little of that in the role-playing game market. Now, sometimes you will have a single player in control of a party, but it's still a single player versus the computer. Do you see anything on the horizon or any reason why we don't see more cooperative role-playing games, why you can't have two or three separate players working on the quest at the same time or working together?
If we were to make a game which was fully multiplayer, apart from a Morpork, obviously, then the actual amount of effort that goes into that to make it multiplayer, it won't be paid off by increased sales. So, as the years go by, more and more people are coming online now. Most games are going to end up being, well, pretty much everything's going to be a Morpork, but a much deeper Morpork than go and grind and go and kill this thing 100 times, which looks the same as that thing. So I believe that pretty much every game will become pretty much fully multiplayer. There will be your standard people who will just want to sit at home and play it by themselves, and they'll cater for that, but I think the multiplayer will become the bigger side of the game, and the single player will be like a skirmish mode on an RTS, or, you know, something, a simpler version of the deeper game. And I think that's one way, certainly, role-playing games can go. And I don't know why they haven't been doing this as much as they could be on Morpogs, which is having player-generated dungeons and things like that in Morpogs. That would be the way I'd be going. If I was working on a Morpog at the moment, you know, you've got some guy running a city and he has to defend his city against the other faction, and he has to go down and make the dungeon himself, because that's like self-generating content, and the player would love to do it. People would love to fight in his dungeon, and from what I can see, that's not a hugely difficult thing to do these days.
No, in fact, they're doing it in City of Heroes already with the player bases.
Quite a simple level, but yeah. Certainly.
Okay, well, let me ask you this as a quest scripter then. If I told you, the quest scripter, that we were going to now have a cooperative multiplayer game, and it had to be possible that every quest that you wrote could be simultaneously worked on by two people, and that they weren't doing it independently, they're doing it cooperatively,
mm-hmm.
would you say there'd be a lot of technical hurdles to make that happen?
It's just complexity. None of it's impossible. Basically, the table I was talking about with the Vizio, with all the boxes, that would probably double in size. What happens if you're talking to this person while your mate is over hitting the person you're then supposed to talk to with a big axe? And things like that.
Then you have the world's best mate.
Yeah, exactly. No, there's been lots of talk about this, and I don't think it's very far away. It's just a size thing, and it's just an amount of work. And generally, it's the thing you do after you've got your base engine working. So the first thing you do is you don't make a multiplayer game. If it's in the standard genre, which is single player, you don't go out and go, we're going to do a multiplayer version of that. The first thing you do is you make a single player version of it. So you could look at games out there, and you could see, all right, okay, we've made this genre-defining game. Let's do it multiplayer next. I can see a lot of places doing that now, but up to now, it hasn't really been worth it. Because of the size of the market. I think that's going to change, and I think almost every genre is going to start heading towards a much more multiplayer society. And,
you know, I just have this mental image of your quest journal being your friend's hit list.
Yeah. Yes, you can have
to deliver a package to Joe? I bet I can get there first and kill Joe.
Well, especially if you're sharing the world, you know, and like your mate's got married to someone, so you just run up and kill his wife. it's not the friendliest thing. That you've really got to trust people you're playing with in a game, you know, which is deeper than a first-person shooter, or is deeper than Gears of War, where all you do is you follow a path, you know, a very, very nice-looking grey path, but follow a path through regions and shooting stuff. But it doesn't really matter if you shoot that monster before he does, because you're both always trying to shoot the monster. And when you've got a role-playing game, you've got decisions. Or some role-playing games, you don't have a huge amount of decisions, but what we do in Fable is, you know, you've got choices, you've got consequences, and if you're playing a game and you've made one choice, and the person you're playing with has made another one, then it gets complicated, because you have to handle, you know, a good and evil choice at the same time, which is a challenge. But it's certainly possible. It's just a case of sitting down and having another 3 weeks of meetings and working out how it could be done if at one point someone said to me, right, this is what we're doing. So,
Speaking of good and evil, this is something that you and I were talking about while Dan was at lunch, and I was kind of complaining that a lot of video games, they allow you to take a good path or an evil path. But the good path is what we would describe as lawful good, and mm-hmm. the evil path is what we would describe as chaotic evil. And so if you have a choice, you know, if a little child comes up and says, you know, hey, could you please give me some money so my family can have dinner? Your choices are A, build the child a house and set up an endowment for his college, B, burn his kitten.
But lawful evil, lawful evil, if you would say that to me and you wanted lawful evil, it's like, take him to the local evil temple and make him, you know, become an acolyte.
Right, so do you see a lot of games moving away from that, where the evil choices, or there's a way to play an evil character that's not just chaotic evil, where you're not just killing puppies and kittens because it's funny?
I think
there's ways to be evil without being mindlessly destructive.
Yeah, I think there's always a way to be lawfully evil, and I just don't think a lot of game makers use that element. I think we're doing it in Fable 2. So I can't say any examples, but we're certainly saying, you can join these evil factions, and because you're joining an evil faction, by definition you're being lawfully evil, unless the faction is chaotic evil, but then it's not really a faction. It's more of a group of individuals running around causing chaos.
Well, something along those lines. I had expressed previously that one of my frustrations with video games is it seems that they, as time goes forward, are more and more aware of what you do, but they still do not really allow you to build much of an image of yourself. For example, let's take a game like Fallout. I think in Fallout you had the measure of karma, which is your measure of good and evil. And mm-hmm. certainly as I went through the game and I did decent or indecent acts, it would know that I was good or evil, and certain people would respond to me differently based on that. But if I perceived myself as sarcastic or hostile or romantic or passionate or passive or whatever, the game had absolutely no awareness of that. And it strikes me, therefore, that in a lot of computer RPGs or console RPGs, your sense of character is still largely internal to you. It's just in your head. Do you see that ever changing within the video game world?
from my point of view, I think Fable started moving that away from that with the whole sense of the clothes you wear and the expressions you do and the reactions you get from people. You can get people calling you foolish, or you can get them taking a mickey out of you if you're not famous enough. If you become more famous, they start to stop taking the mickey out of you and going, oh, no, that looks fine, and things like that. And again, on Fable 2, we're taking it to a much deeper level. There's a lot more reactions you can get out of people, from walking down the street wearing a silly hat to a normal hat to having a beard that, and different AI characters will like different things on you. So you can walk down the street and look a complete idiot, and then someone will go, hey, I think that suits you though, you know, and someone else will be saying, no, he's an idiot. And basically you get a sense of however you dress, people will respond to you depending on what they think about that. And we did it to a certain degree in Fable, and we're working on it a lot more in Fable 2. I think it's pretty cool, but I do agree that there's not many games that do it. You know, you can dress how you want, and someone will just talk to you in exactly the same way they were going to talk to you anyway, which seems a bit of a waste, because it's a pretty easy thing to see what the player's doing and, you know, and what they're wearing and what they've done. And we had good and evil in Fable. I can't tell you what, but we've got an extra scale in Fable 2 as well, which is tracking other things you've been doing. And that's something that hasn't been done before. It's a second scale, which is really interesting, and I really like it.
Well, could I maybe explore that a little bit more broadly? Because we talked about this in Bonus 10. When it seems like with a lot of common video games now, when you're interacting with the world or the non-player characters, they have a sense about whether you are positively or negatively aligned with their faction, and they have a sense of your power. Either, you know, you're weak or you're powerful. And so it definitely seems like in many games now, the NPCs are aware of what I kind of considered your level and your notoriety.
Mm-hmm.
But that seemed to kind of end there, and then different branches of the decision tree were available or precluded to you based on whether or not they liked you enough or you were powerful enough.
Yeah.
In a broader sense, what are some, I guess, other ways that you could do this? I mean, you indicated your clothing that, for example, in Saints Row, your gang's color was purple, and the more purple you wore, the more street cred you could earn for your gang, and that was based just purely on your clothing.
Well, sure, if you've got a city, and the elements of the city are the poor people, the middle classes, and the posh people. If you wear poor clothing, the poor people will like you, the upper class won't, and vice versa. You know, if you dress a certain way, then people like you. If you have tattoos, then it's more likely a bandit or a gypsy will like you, but again, less likely someone who lives in a posh town will like you. It's trying to get a sense of you're defining who you are, and the actions you do, and the quests you do, necessarily, the more renowned, the more evil, or the more good you are. And also, with things like Morrowind and things like that, again, it's the factions you help, they start treating you differently. So if you meet people from certain factions, they'll treat you differently. Not your overall renown, but your faction renown will go up, because you helped the thieves, say, for example, then the guards dislike you. And all that kind of interaction, you know, you can certainly do, and that is defining who your character is in generally. It's not just necessarily how many hit points you've got or how many people you've killed. It's who you've killed, and if you've got different towns or different religions against each other in a game, then it's a case of if you help one, you're always hindering yourself against someone else, and I always find that really interesting, especially if quests open up or close dependent on who you've helped later on in the game. And there's certainly no reason why every character in the game couldn't have an opinion of you, and if you're nice, if you get their opinion of you to a certain point, they could give you something. It could be worth making every single person love you in the game, which obviously you couldn't do at the same time. So it's a case of, oh, this guy over here, what's he like? Oh, he's this kind of guy. He's a blacksmith, say, for example. Oh, if he really likes me, he'd give me cheap weapons. We're not saying make that blacksmith like you because he'll give you cheap weapons. But that's, as I say, emergent gameplay. Just because that's what his character does, you now have to find out what he likes. You can determine what your quests are in some respects. It's like, there's, I don't know, a mayor or something, and you want he's got a certain job he can give you, but I only give it to you if he likes you enough, so you have to dress smartly and get a proper handlebar moustache because he thinks that's cool, and, you know, that kind of thing is determining who the player is and the reactions they get based on how someone perceives them.
As someone that does a role-playing game podcast, I have heard a lot of frustration coming from the tabletop gamers that the video game industry has already leached a lot of particularly younger players away from ever even giving tabletop gaming a try. And in some interviews we've had recently with other people, they have mentioned to us that their concern is as Moore's Law marches forward and as video gaming is capable of doing more and more, because I would say right now there are a lot of aspects of tabletop gaming that a video game just cannot recreate. AI is the big one we've been talking about. But as Moore's Law marches forward, those barriers may eventually get broken down. How do you respond to that? Do you see video gaming eventually undoing tabletop gaming completely, or you think that's just never going to happen?
That's a good question. I think, basically, it depends on who you are. I think if you're someone who loves going around to your mate's house and playing games with them, it doesn't matter if you can play them online. I mean, take something like, I mean, it's not role-playing, but obviously, but take Magic the Gathering. You can play Magic the Gathering online now. It's no different to playing it face-to-face with someone with real cards, but millions of people still play it with real cards. It hasn't destroyed Magic the Gathering. It's created a new version for people that haven't got many players that live near them. So they go and play it online, and there's always someone to play against. Whereas if you've got a group of people that meet every week, they're going to carry on meeting every week. They're not going to say, well, I'm not going to go and talk to you anymore. I'm going to, you know, just go online and talk to someone I don't know. Because it's friendships and it's account, you know, especially with tabletop, you've got a campaign setting. I mean, the game that's probably closest is Neverwinter Nights 2, where you can have a campaign, you can have the same players come on every week. But at the moment, as you know, it's not got the same depth. I don't think it's going to get the same depth. It's going to give you a different game. It's going to give you more impressive visuals. I don't think it's ever going to manage to give you the same width of choices, the same breadth of what you can actually do.
I have to agree with Mike that we've been going on and on about replicating a game master's brain in artificial intelligence, but I think we're completely missing out on the fact that it's just fun to go sit in your friend's basement until 2 o'clock in the morning.
Totally. Yeah.
There's definitely a community aspect, and there's value to just getting together with your friends. One statistic we found on Xbox Live is the likelihood of a person to resubscribe is directly proportional to the length of their friends list, that the more friends they have, the more likely they are to come back. I have to agree with Mike that I don't think computer games are going to completely replace the experience of sitting in a basement with your friends, no matter how good the artificial intelligence is.
We actually had someone make the point on our forums that probably one of the oldest tabletop games to be perfectly replicated by a video game engine is chess. Yet as it stands today, I have played far more people on a chess board than I don't think I've ever even been approached by someone to play them in electronic chess. And I agree that there is something that I don't think video games will ever be able to take away from it, but it doesn't seem to always stop a lot of the doom and gloom in the tabletop industry that they are facing their end of days at the hands of the electronic industry.
I mean, I play board games, and I'm pretty sure I could play every one of the board games I own online. Yet, I'd much rather have a few mates over and just sit and play them on an evening and, you know, take the mick out of them to their face, going, ah, you're rubbish, you know, to someone's face is so much more fun than doing it online. So you'll never be able to get that. And it's the camaraderie, and it's just meeting up and saying hi. And for me, you know, you can meet up with your friends and go down the pub, or you can meet up with your friends and come over and have a game, you know, and it's just a different form of social interaction. And that's not the same as going and think, I'm going to go and sit upstairs on the computer by myself and talk to some guy in Canada. That's simply not the same thing. And I see it as a social event, and it's one of my social interactions in life.
Well, Mike, as we bring this home, sitting here, you've got the ear of a pretty large number of people. I don't know the exact number. I tried to give Ryan Dancy an estimate during his interview, and within a matter of days, the downloads on that actually surpassed the number I told him, which is probably to his credit more than ours. But you have the ear of some large number of people. Anything you want to say, go for it.
I just think, as it goes on, the games industry is certainly going to be able to aim more and more stuff to what you guys are wanting to play, but that shouldn't stop anyone playing what they're playing now, because if you enjoy it, it doesn't matter, really.
All right, well, thank you very much, Mike, and thank you as well, Tex, for joining us from out there in Seattle. And to you, the listeners, we want to thank you as well for tuning in, and we will catch you guys next time.
Yeah, thanks very much.
This interview has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2007, fully owned by its host. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com.